This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. You know, when it gets cold in February and the snow piles up and we start, you know, wishing for a different season, it's nice to warm up to a good old radio and talk to a couple of philosophers about what excites them. And we've got two great philosophers to talk to because one of them is well known to our radio audience here on Main Street. Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life, which you hear the second Sunday of every month at 5 o'clock right here on the Prairie Public Network. And Jack, sitting next to you today, is your dad. Introduce Mark Weinstein to our listeners.
Well, first of all, hi, Doug. It's good to hear from you. And, you know, it's the weather, and I'm fantasizing about taking those walks on those North Dakota beaches and those nice hikes in the North Dakota mountains. Yeah. It's the best part of February is fantasizing about that. I have brought someone to suffer with us through the negative 20 degree weather. My father, Mark Weinstein, who is a professor of education at Montclair State University, has a PhD in philosophy, like myself, but is a legendary jazz flute player, and that's why we've brought him here, because Y Radio's 10th birthday celebration is featuring him in a discussion called The Logic of Jazz. Hi, Pops.
Hey.
Hello, Mark. Good to have you with us. Now, if you were back in Montclair, New Jersey, talking to your class, how would you introduce your son Jack to them?
I don't think you want that answer, actually.
Oh, yes, I do.
I would actually sing a song from Horse Feathers, but we won't get into that. Jack is the apple of my eye, has fallen far from the tree. His level of success has exceeded certainly anything that I ever aspired to. And
all of your expectations, actually.
Well, we won't go into that. And the fact of the matter is that I couldn't be prouder of what he's done to bring the connection between philosophy and public life to people by presenting experts who have deep knowledge of things, and Jack gets them to talk in a way that ordinary people can understand, appreciate, and learn from. So I couldn't be prouder of my boy.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Father and son together on the radio talking about the show they're going to be doing tomorrow at the Empire Arts Center. Jack, it's called The Logic of Jazz. Your dad is a pretty well-known jazz artist. So talk about the theme of your discussion tomorrow.
So here's the problem. In the United States especially, we don't have a really good conversation about creativity. We think you invent stuff out of nothing, right? That you just have these ideas. But that's not what art is. Art is creativity in the face of constraints. There are rules, and you have to figure out how to work within those rules to invent something new. And when I was thinking about the conversation I wanted to have for the 10th anniversary and the conversation I wanted to have with my father, I thought, what is jazz but improvisation in the face of rules, and then figuring out how to change and bend those rules as you make new discoveries. So in a technical sense, and this is going to be a big phrase, but in the technical sense, we're going to talk about the rationality of jazz and the rationality of creativity. In other words, how our minds logically create connections to discover something new. And jazz is possibly the best medium for doing that.
Well, that describes improvisation, I guess. Mark, you were in your 30s when you decided to pursue a PhD in what, the mathematical logic or the logic of mathematics? Is that what it is?
Well, when I was a musician, and in those days you had to take the graduate record exam in order to get into a PhD program.
The GRE,
and you had to take it in three fields: language, mathematics, and your specialization. And I scored off of the chart in language, and amazingly, given the fact that I had a weak undergraduate minor in philosophy, off of the chart in philosophy. But I was in the lower 34th percentile in quantitative skills. So when I became, and I was in my 30s, when I became a philosophy major, I always felt I was a little bit of a fraud. So I took logic in order to overcompensate for the fact that I'd always been really bad at math. And I got an A in logic. So I said, this can't be logic. So I took another logic course. I got another A. So I said, this really can't be logic. So I then got a special studies in advanced logic. I got an A in that, and then I was sunk. I had to write my dissertation in logic. But I didn't know anything really about math, and I was always an enormous fan of the Isaac Asimov books on science. Now, I was a musician, and I took, you know, the Rocks for Jocks science requirement in college, but I loved to read about science. So I started to think about the logic of science based upon not the rules of science, Jack, excuse me, but the practice of science. And I started to see if you could give a mathematical description of what scientists actually do. And that's basically, besides everything else I do in my career, what my research interests are. I write on the logic of chemistry, and I'm trying to figure out not the weird parts of science, but the parts about science that everybody agrees on. And why does everybody agree? Yeah. And it's more than that it works. It's a lot more than that it works. So that's what I do. I do sort of abstract descriptions of scientific discourse and scientific practice.
Well, Jack, what's it like to be at a dinner table with your dad? Are you talking about jazz or philosophy? Or when you talk about philosophy, do you disagree?
It's been a very strange experience, actually, because we disagree about most things in every way. But then once we get to it, we discover that not only do we agree, but that people have told us that we teach in the same way, that we have accidentally come up with the same interests. Once, when I was teaching at Fresno State, I had invited him up to give a talk, and a bunch of my students were in the audience. And I had given my talk, and then he starts talking, and the students just start laughing hysterically. Everyone in the audience is just bowled over, and we try to figure out why. And so we stop and ask, and they all say, he's doing exactly the same gestures that I am. He's doing all the same mannerisms. And so it's an interesting juxtaposition because on the one hand, we have very different ways of looking at things and very different ways of approaching things, and that will certainly come out in the conversation tomorrow. But we also have this tremendous overlap due to the fact that we have spent a lot of time together. I lived with him, you know, for much of my life, even after my parents got divorced. And there's a symbiosis. There's a togetherness that has always been present. And so what I'm hoping, of course, as I hoped for when my wife was the guest on the show a couple months ago, that the good stuff rather than the interpersonal stuff appears for the audience.
Okay. Well, was your interest in philosophy predestined or was it a coincidence?
You know, I can't answer that because I didn't choose philosophy. Philosophy chose me. And my experience of being in – actually, my first class in college was an intro to logic class as well, although I've never been particularly good at it. And then intro to philosophy, the way that I always describe it is – there was this thing I was doing my entire life, and I didn't know it had a name. And so when it became called philosophy, I knew what I was supposed to do. And that's weird since I had grown up completely immersed in philosophy. But, you know, I have a 13-year-old daughter. I tell her to read stuff all the time. She is completely uninterested in it. I tell her to listen to music. She is completely uninterested. And so I assume that there is that parallel experience that he had all of these suggestions, and I thought, why do I want to do what my father does? Why am I interested in what he's doing? I'm going to do my own thing. But then we ended up on a very similar path.
Well, it's very interesting to somebody who isn't a member of your family to realize that your dad was a, you know, pretty accomplished musician before he went on to his doctorate in philosophy. So, Mark, tell us about how you got started in jazz.
I was a poor boy. my parents are immigrants, and I was raised in public housing in Brooklyn. And kids in public housing who want to be upwardly mobile become athletes or boxers preferentially. And I was a little bit of a namby-pamby. And so I saw music as a way to get out of the projects, quite frankly. And music was my father was a house painter, and he'd come home covered with red paint. And I said to myself, I never want to work for a living. And so I became a musician.
Uh-huh.
And then I discovered that there's an easier way not to work for a living, and I became a professor.
You're blowing my scam here, Pops. I've made this look good in North Dakota for 18 years. In 3 minutes, he blows my cover.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that your father is from Ukraine, and yet you're pretty well known as a Latin kind of Cuban jazz artist, aren't you?
Yep. I was really, really lucky. I was a trombone player, and I hit the music scene just when the trombone became the sort of characteristic instrument of New York salsa. And it was a band called Eddie Palmieri that I played with, very famous band, but that's not the important part. The important part was that Latin bands, what they used to call rumba bands, basically played for Jewish audiences up in the Catskill Mountains. And Eddie Palmieri and another guy named Orlando Marin and another guy named Pacheco played in a loft painted black in the South Bronx on Southern Boulevard called the Triton Club. And we played for Puerto Rican kids. And we were the music that developed Puerto Rican self-awareness, where Latin kids didn't have to be embarrassed of Latin music. And I then spent 10 years immersed with Cuban and Puerto Rican and Dominican musicians. And there was something about playing that music that was tremendously free, but that connected with my aspirations to be a jazz musician. So I spent a lot of happy years playing with what they now call salsa bands.
Well, let's play a little riff of this, Jack, because some of this music that your dad plays is in your show. Let's hear this. Right, Mark, you were playing trombone, but now you're playing flute. That's an unusual combination.
Well, the music that you're playing is music that's, you know, I had the tiger by the tail. That's Brazilian music. That's a choro. And that's music that is folk music from Brazil, and it's written. It's not improvised, and it's marvelous music. And it's the kind of thing that you couldn't play on a trombone if you tried. And that's one of the reasons why I play flute.
Well, Jack, you grew up in a household that probably had a little jazz playing occasionally. Did you ever pick up an instrument?
You know, I had a brief flirtation with the saxophone that my father says I did very, very well with. And then it went by the wayside. I taught myself to play a little bass in college and then ended up picking up the guitar to learn how to write songs. When I lived in Vienna, Austria, which longtime listeners know I did, I brought the guitar and ended up playing guitar on the street to live for about a year. I went for 6 months. I stayed for a year and a half.
Wow.
But I've never considered myself a musician. I've considered myself a performer. You know, I have a very, very basic working ability to play and sing, and I can do it to make some money on the street and meet the attractive person that I want to talk to. But I've never had the skill, and I've never had the mathematical, the musical knowledge, which actually has been interesting because about 4 or 5 years ago, I decided I wanted to take some music classes at UND to learn music theory and skill and technique. And I decided in my spare time that I was going to very slowly get a BA in music. Then I discovered I had no spare time and it sort of went by the wayside. But growing up in a household where the musicality was so advanced and so important, and getting to hear my father play all the time, that had a very profound effect on me, but also, and he doesn't know what I'm about to say, now that I practice the guitar regularly at home, I actually take great pleasure in playing scales because I used to hear him play all of the time and make fun of him on the flute going do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you know, all these scales and individual notes. And now there's something incredibly comforting about it to such an extent that I think that when I practice, I overplay that sort of stuff and don't really know that many songs.
Jack Russell Weinstein is a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota and the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. His dad, Mark, teaches at Montclair State University in New Jersey, and they're both going to be on stage at the Empire Arts Center tomorrow evening, and the doors open at 6:30. There's some refreshments, a little light food, I take it, and the show starts at 7, and the show is titled The Logic of Jazz. Jack, how do you envision this public discussion?
Well, we're going to start with a reception. Everyone gets to eat because we're not going to, you know, we're Jewish. We're going to feed you, right? And then we'll have the conversation on the stage. There'll be an intermission. And then my dad is going to play with a local klezmer group. Tamara Auer, who runs the Grand Forks Symphony, has this group of students who have been playing with Ukrainian, Bulgarian, even a little Turkish music, and he's going to sit in with them. He's been very insistent that he wanted this trip to be very student-centered and to give them an experience. In fact, after this conversation, we're going to the music department. He's going to give a master class to the jazz students and then a conversation with the department. After that, if people are still willing to sit around, there'll be an informal question-answer session with me about why radio and the experiences of doing philosophy in North Dakota. There'll be more food, of course. And my goal really is to do what I try to do with the radio show all the time, which is not teach anyone anything, but to explore some ideas at the same time that the audience does, to ask the questions that the audience may not know that they want to ask but are very happy to hear. And then, of course, during the show, there'll be a mic in the audience and people can ask questions. So there'll be a sort of more formal conversation, but there'll also be food and fun and informal time, and everyone will get a chance to meet my dad and afterwards and to chat with him and to meet with me and just to celebrate the 10 years of Y Radio and to celebrate jazz and music and the opportunity that you know, we live in a world where this can happen in North Dakota as well as in Manhattan.
Well, it's wonderful to hear about it. And, of course, we'll mention it a couple of times because we want our listeners, especially those in the Grand Forks area, to take this in.
It's also free. That's very important. One of my principal ideas about why is that everything we do, everything the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life does, is free and accessible to the public. It doesn't matter how many people you bring, it's still going to be free. So everyone in the sound of this voice, come on by. As long as there's room in the theater, you're welcome.
It's a free exchange of ideas.
Literally and figuratively.
Mark, klezmer music, too. Is there a, I guess that's part of your ethnic background, I take it.
Yep. My mother's brother was a klezmer musician from Poland, and I've made a number of albums where I tried to blend klezmer and jazz, and wow. Now that I'm semi-retired, I'm playing basically Jewish, both religious and secular music with some amateur musicians from my temple, from my place of worship, and it's good to get be home. It's good to, after playing the music of the world, play the music that's associated with my history and my background.
Now, when you perform jazz, do you prefer to just free improvisation, or do you start with a sheet of music like you'll probably have to tomorrow with, you know, your klezmer band, right?
One of the things that I guess Jack and I will get to explore is his concept of math and rules and my concept of math and rules, which I think are rather different. And although music is written and there's a sheet and there may be chords and there may be a structure, that's sort of like a roadmap. But what goes on, of course, is the journey. And the journey has some relationship to the roadmap, but in no way can it be reduced to the roadmap. So whether we're playing completely free, as we do on some of my more adventurous albums. I did an album with African musicians in Berlin where we walked into a studio with no music, no ideas. We'd never played together and just played for 2 days.
Wow.
And other times, like the piece you played, we're just reading the notes. But whatever you do, it's infused with the moment. It's infused with the expression of what you as a musician are doing right now. A musician doesn't play music. A musician hears music. And they hear the music that they play, and they respond to the sound of music that they're making. So it's this constant reflective, in real time, at tremendous speed, constant reflection of constantly being aware of what you're doing and letting that in some unconscious way determine what your next step is. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's the best I can do.
It makes a lot of sense. And Jack, this is an intriguing idea because when you immerse yourself in an art form, whether it's music or writing or drama or something like that, when you learn the techniques, the pieces that you have to learn, you have to learn how to play a flute or a trombone, and you have to learn how to read notes perhaps. But then you get into the moment. It's an emotional release. It suddenly, there's no logic there, is there?
Well, it's sort of complicated, and it has to do with being a human being on many, many different levels, right? If you're playing music with other people, you have to be attentive to them and what they're doing. You have to be attentive to your own vision. But you also need to experience what one author called flow, which is being in the moment and just trusting that where your heart and where your soul takes you is a meaningful place to go. This is more obviously a question that my father can answer, but certainly one way of thinking about it is to think about how we all felt about music when we were teenagers. Again, I mentioned my daughter, Adina, who's 13, and she is going through what I certainly went through at that age, which is picking a style of music that she loves and creating an identity around it, picking clothing that she wants based on it and friends that she has based on it. Because there is something on the existential level, on the spiritual level, at the heart of the human experience that music speaks to. And when you're a fan, when you're an audience member, when you hear it, it lets you be something that you don't have the vocabulary to articulate. It lets you feel things that you don't necessarily have the emotional sophistication to really control. And I am sure that as a musician, that experience, while it's a mirrored experience, while you're creating rather than, you're much more active than passive the way a listener is, it's going to have all of that same stuff. And my goal tomorrow is to explore this because, as always, the less I know about the subject, the better the conversation is going
to
be.
Well, it sounds to me like you and your father, Mark, will be improvising a bit around the idea of philosophy and perhaps demonstrating it with some music. But there's a joy in expressing yourself, and I think the audience will enjoy taking that in tomorrow. This is the 10th anniversary celebration of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life with host Jack Russell Weinstein and his father, Mark Weinstein, a very well-known jazz performer. It's Tuesday at 7 p.m. The doors open at 6:30 for a nosh. It's at the Empire Arts Center in downtown Grand Forks, and again, it is free and open to the public. Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Doug, so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll have an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast about the importance of general education for college preparation. And we'll also have an excerpt from the Simple Self-Care podcast with host Randy Kaye with tips keeping your body moving while at a desk job. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. With the state legislature on their crossover break, House Majority Leader Chet Pollard says we're doing all right. Pollard says when you factor in fund transfers, and the session is in a similar situation to 2 years ago.
Both the House and the Senate got to take a look at what bills have survived and There's some things that the House likes that maybe the Senate does and vice versa. So I think we're doing all right.
Pollard says each day has its own challenges. Legislative observers have been critical of lawmakers for leaning too much on the state's legacy fund. Pollard says there's some merit to those complaints.
We'd really like it if we could have those dollars kind of saved up for 2 years or do something with them instead of spending them before they actually become available.
Pollard says with bills moving from one chamber to the other, look for the intensity to ratchet up as the legislation comes under closer scrutiny in the remaining weeks of the session. A bill is making its way through the legislature that expands the state's academic and career and technology work scholarships normally offered to high school graduates to high school students who are taking dual credit courses. Castleton Republican Representative Brandi Pyle introduced the bill.
Right now, when students are taking dual credit, parents or students are paying 100% of those costs. They're not eligible for financial aid, scholarships, or anything of that sort. So by expanding it down into the dual credit, so where they get high school and college credit, I think we're offering an opportunity to get kids through college a little bit quicker and hopefully, you know, not carrying quite so much debt load as they graduate.
The measure passed the House 87-5 and will now be considered by the Senate. And when the North Dakota House passed the budget for the Information Technology Department, it did not include money for the plan to consolidate all state government IT services into that one department.
The House just did not feel comfortable moving forward with the governor's recommendation.
Grand Forks Democratic Representative Corey Mock is a member of the House Appropriations Committee.
We haven't completely closed the door on the idea, but we wanted to get a little bit more information, make sure that this is not going to increase the cost of IT services. We figured it was best to give the Senate a chance to hear it out and make a decision whether or not to add it back in.
Mock says he thinks the IT budget bill may be one of the last bills decided on before the legislature adjourns. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. What makes a well-educated person? In higher education, that question is answered with a series of courses to develop key intellectual skills. Sometimes referred to as general studies, these required classes introduce students to the arts and sciences and help develop communication skills. Today, we'll share an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast that explores general education. As in other states, the North Dakota University System wants credits for these courses to be transferable to other colleges and universities, which requires coordination in course content and expected outcomes. Cutting Ed host Tom Gerhart talks with guests Ann Kelsch, Ryan Zerr, and Melissa Gelstead from the University of North Dakota. We pick up the discussion with the importance of collaboration to provide quality general education in the 21st century.
You know, we're fortunate. There are think tanks and different organizations that do research and give us data that tells us about, for example, what employers want, what students want, what people want in terms of when they are out in their career for some time. And so we have a lot of survey data that supports the way in which we sort of try to forecast these goals. But the employer data is really persuasive. Employers talk about finding very important in their future employees all the things that we articulate as these general education goals, things like effective oral and written communication, critical thinking and analytic reasoning, right? The ability to work with others, all of those kinds of skills are the exact ones that employers say they want. And it's really interesting because employer survey data often indicates they care less about a particular major oftentimes than they do about that skill set. And that's very counter to what many people think. Many people think, oh, I've got to get a degree in a very specified thing. But many jobs today, there's a lot of on-the-job training that can happen. But if you don't have the ability to think well, to write well, right, if you're not good at with information literacy or quantitative reasoning, right, those aren't necessarily on-the-job skills that you're gonna get.
Is our K-12 system doing a good job of presenting our higher ed institutions with students that have some of those skills, the critical thinking, the collaborative skills, the communicative skills? Are you getting students that are ready to embrace what you want to do here at UND and other places across the state?
It's hard to be an Olympic athlete by just going to the gym one time. So these are things that aren't necessarily skills that students will have mastered by the time they are at any level of study. So it's, I think there's of course a variety of students' ability on all topics. But these are things that, again, to talk about this embeddedness in the curriculum, these are things that we continue to practice all the time. I need help with my writing and my communication skills. And these are things that we work with students on constantly through their time at UND. So I think that they're well-trained students that we receive, and we work them even harder.
Yeah.
So thinking about those essential intellectual skills and how they can carry those with them as a toolkit that they hone and develop and continue to add to as they're switching through jobs and careers throughout their lives, we think is critical. There's a lot of talk also in the literature about what kinds of jobs we're preparing students for and how we can't foresee what kinds of jobs will be needed in the future. And so how do we help best think about what those students will need as they go forward and try to meet those evolving needs? And part of that is also to cultivate the joy of learning, to make lifelong learners to be curious, to find time not only when they're at their job, obviously, but when they're not at their job. What are they wanting to know? How are they following along? How are they participating in the world, their communities? Democracy has been mentioned. How do we do this work that creates an informed citizenship for folks who want to know, folks who ask good questions, folks who pay attention and follow along and contribute to the communities in which they live? It was mentioned in a current context of pick your local or national, international issues, what folks are passionate about, how we decipher news and fake news, contribute on social media, understand texts in a variety of platforms, and how we engage with the world. All of the intellectual skills that we're talking about in a kind of gen ed program like Essential Studies are things that we've been focusing on, practicing on, and getting students to engage with and try out and test in this environment so that they can move into the world and be informed citizens.
You said, Brian, that UND values the importance of gen ed and has institutionalized key features. Tell me about some of those features.
Sure. Well, the one I'll mention right away is the one that came up a little bit earlier, the idea of a capstone course. And so these courses, they can mean different things in different disciplinary contexts, but roughly speaking, they provide an opportunity for a student to do research or do something that represents a kind of substantial dive into whatever it is the discipline might be. And so, you know, examples that come quickly to mind, you know, include instances where perhaps a student in engineering is working on a design project, and that design project involves not just, you know, building, you know, a particular mechanism, but also all of the background work that would have been necessary to design it properly and gain some sense of its capabilities. Well, these are really pulling together skills that come, you know, as part of the Essential Studies program. And therefore, that type of a project represents a way for the student to bring those pieces together to really show off what it is they're able to do at the point of graduation.
Melissa?
One of the ways in which UND's Essential Study program has evolved and has changed, that is a change to our intercultural knowledge and skills, where we're converting classes or taking a hard look at the kinds of learning outcomes and goals that we have in the courses that we previously have had validated for our diversity outcomes and ratcheting those up a bit into this intercultural knowledge and skills category. And so we're moving forward and looking at the diversity of human experience as one of the categories in there and analyzing worldview, again, in a sort of scaffolding way, ensuring that students have vocabulary to tackle some of the tough, wicked problems that we have going on in the world, being able to develop that self-awareness, awareness of and engagement with diverse others, and how to address some of those challenges and move forward and think about them and tease apart the complexities of them.
I happen to have a senior in high school who's looking ahead to his possibilities for his future. As a high school student, when I go back and talk to him about our conversation, as he thinks ahead to college, what should he and others know about gen ed? Melissa, I guess we could just start with you.
Right. Well, as a kid from a small town in North Dakota, you know, going to a university gave me the opportunity to take classes that I hadn't had access to in my small town. And so that was really that window of opportunity in the educational exploration too. I had a plan, I had a program of study, I knew what I wanted to do, but I could dabble. And my dabbling led me down some interesting roads. So that gets to sort of the breadth earlier conversation and just being able to look at the wealth of opportunity and being able to explore things that you're curious about and might lead to a certificate, a minor, maybe a double major. And that's often a conversation I have, for example, with my language acquisition students who may not have thought they were interested in majoring in a language, but suddenly they do. And so that opportunity to try out something new and flex some of those muscles that you didn't know you had and built. And that's one element that's important to me in thinking about Gen Ed.
Well, and you know, I'll add to that by saying that so that the student who's about to attend college and therefore be faced with this question, you know, what should I be thinking about in choosing not only a major but my Gen Ed courses, I would suggest that they should be thinking about the fact that, you know, when they graduate and they start a career, it's quite possible that what they thought that career meant will be completely different than what it actually means. And so, I mean, if I were to use myself as an example, I would argue that what I predominantly do now in my job bears little resemblance to what I would have imagined my undergraduate degree was preparing me for relative to just the major. And so I think, you know, this notion that a career will evolve, a career will likely, you know, involve instances where at that point a graduate wants to, you know, advance and become a manager or in some way, you know, rise above an entry-level position. This is really where one can, you know, use Gen Ed to their advantage. Now, you know, that's not always going to be clear to the you know, the freshman student, but maybe that perspective will help frame it in a way that makes Gen Ed seem more valuable than it sometimes can.
I also think about adding on the how that transfers outside of the classroom, what they're in the, when they're in the university, whether that's it could be from the classroom to the lab, where you could be involved in sort of research work. Undergraduate research is another one of the high impact practices that Anne was talking about earlier, in all forms. Thinking about internships, also been mentioned today, or other kind of cooperative education experiences, service learning projects that get folks out into the community and do work that's based on that. Another one passion of mine, study abroad, right? Being able to take those skills learned in the classroom at home and then test those out in embedded and immersed in another culture and another educational system, being able to have that comparative perspective to see how the American education system measures up to, contrasts with educational systems in other countries. Those kinds of opportunities that exist at colleges and universities across the state are other, oftentimes embedded in the general education program, that allow students doors that they might not have thought to knock on in earlier conversations. And so thinking about what kinds of co-curricular and embedded academic experiences are in those kinds of classroom opportunities are also critical elements.
Trying to attract students is a very competitive business. Ryan, I guess talk about, go with that just a little bit more in that context.
That is an interesting point, because I think generally the you know, the marketing about higher education is focused on the majors, right? So what disciplines can I major in by going to institution X? And so what importance should we attach to, you know, in helping advise students to the idea that, yes, you can certainly major in those disciplines, but in addition to that, you need to know that at these institutions within North Dakota, the general education program is really of a high caliber. And so not only are you getting, you know, a high quality education in, I'll come back to mathematics, my discipline, but you're also getting a high quality general education, which, you know, the coupling of the two is clearly going to be an advantage once you graduate. So frankly, I don't think we do enough of that promotion around general education, but perhaps this podcast is a chance to change and begin telling the story a little bit more fully.
I think, too, the ability to many of these, and thinking about intercultural knowledge and skills, for an example, these are often tough conversations to have with students. They get at deeply embedded beliefs, perceptions, standpoints, and ways in which we view the world. And so it often creates an opportunity to develop a really strong faculty-student relationship where allowed in a safe space of a classroom, you have the chance to really wrestle with ideas that are deeply felt and evoke a lot of passion and anger and frustration, and a chance to talk through those things, write through those things, and find different ways to hone some of those skills. So I think being able to do that in a place like North Dakota, where smaller class sizes often allow you to have those kinds of relationships, is a real benefit to the students in being able to think through some of these really hard and sticky questions.
Melissa Gelsted, Ann Kelsch, Ryan Zier, thank you for joining me on this episode of the Cutting Ed Podcast.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you.
That was Tom Gearhart, host of the Cutting Ed Podcast, with guests Ann Kelsch, Ryan Zier, and Melissa Gelsted from the University of North Dakota. The Cutting Ed is a collaboration of North Dakota United, Prairie Public, and entrepreneur Ted Dentersmith. You can hear more of the Cutting Ed at ndunited.org. Coming up on Main Street, some tips from Randy Kay to work on fitness while you're at work.
Dickinson State University is hosting the Rural Women on the Western Edge Conference to develop leadership and networking on Friday, March 22nd and Saturday, March 23rd. With the theme Blazers and Blue Jeans, this event empowers and connects women with resources and information to inspire leadership and help build strong communities. Registration includes a Friday reception at 7 p.m. with keynote speaker Elizabeth Shipstead and breakout sessions throughout Saturday. Information and registration at dickinsonstate.edu/RWC.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. The days are getting longer, but we're still experiencing a long, hard winter. Cold temperatures create an almost instinctual desire to hibernate and can increase aches and pains. From the Simple Self-Care Podcast, host Randy Kay has tips on easing discomfort and keeping your body moving while at a desk job.
So, winter. We know it's a time for slowing down, introspection, tuning inward, but sometimes we can go a little overboard with that and get a little, well, hunchy, you know, like physically hunched over. We cozy up and curl inward and then, like, never move again. Especially in the colder areas of the world, like, say you live where I live, in Fargo, North Dakota. And then it's like we get glued to our devices, hibernating as we hunker down on work projects, mindless Instagram scrolling, or getting caught up on shows like maybe Game of Thrones before April. Am I right? Okay. And you might be feeling it in your body. It's common to have more body pain in the winter. We are more tense with the cold weather, and we are usually moving our body less, and it's like everything gets a bit frozen. I know spring is just around the bend, but we aren't quite there yet, and you've probably been accumulating some extra stiffness and stagnation. But I want to help you with this. I want to offer you some solutions to keeping things moving and grooving and, well, less hunchy this time of year. Let's start with this. Have you ever been working on something on your computer and then all of a sudden you look up and like 3 hours went by? Or where are my winter crafters at? I know how much you nimbly crochet or whatever you do for hours on end. And maybe that's a little bit better than screen time, but it's still pretty wearing. You see, no matter what we seem to be doing, our culture has shifted to a sitting culture. We sit when we eat, when we commute, when we work, when we veg out at the end of the day. And the result of living that way day in and day out is, well, not good. In fact, studies have shown that it's actually quite dangerous. Doctors have been saying that sitting is the new smoking, meaning that long-term effects of sitting can be just as deadly as what can come from smoking. There are even new conditions popping up like sitting disease, no joke, and text neck. I'm not trying to scare you here. I just think it's important that you know what's up and what's actually happening with that precious body of yours. And there are some really simple and easy things you can do to counter these effects. They are so simple, in fact, that we commonly disregard them and forget that we can easily switch things up. So here are my top three. Number one, set your timers. Time flies when you are glued to a screen. And the more time you are in one place, the more the damage is done. Studies have shown that breaking up your day with movement is more effective in countering the negative effects of sitting than exercising before or after work. Daily exercise has other wonderful benefits, but the moment we lock ourselves in place is the moment we train our body how to be. So set a timer on your phone, computer, wherever, and remind yourself to get up, do some gentle stretching or movement, walk around a bit, and switch things up. Number two, move and breathe. I know this one sounds like a given, but moving and breathing mindfully throughout your day is so, so, so important. When we take short and shallow breaths, we are misusing our breathing muscles, and that can add all sorts of wear and tear on those tiny little muscles. But if we take deep belly breaths, we are awakening those powerful and important abdominal muscles. We trigger the restful parasympathetic nervous system, and we allow our body to operate optimally. I have various desk exercises and breathing meditations in my Desk Happy online course, but here's a quickie for you. All right, sit comfortably in your chair, the spine nice and straight, shoulders relaxed, and place one hand on your belly and the other on your chest. Take a few deep breaths and make sure the hand on your belly is the one rising and falling. It's like you are pushing that hand out with your breath. And the one on your chest stays still, just naturally following along. Do that a few times. Nice and slow. Notice your body calm down. Notice your mind calm down. Now, rest your hands at your sides and let your head gently fall to one side. Keep that belly breath going, but use your exhalation to continue to let your neck relax. When you are ready, move the head to the other side. Don't force the stretch. Just go to your stopping point. Breathe. Relax. Now gently roll your head down, stretching the back of the neck. Hold for a few breaths, and then bring your head back up to neutral and return back to your normal breath. Notice just how that little bit made you feel. Did it shift some energy? Relieve some stress? This simple exercise can be a lifesaver during high stress times. Trust me. And trust that a little goes a long way. And number three, optimize your daily habits. With self-care, it's not always what you do, it's how you are doing it. With our work or other device-bound activities, we can't just flat out stop doing it. So we need to change our habits around these activities. Here are a few examples for a desk working environment. Use the stairs instead of the elevator. Park far away from your office entrance so you can get your steps in. Stand up while talking. One of my favorites is staying hydrated. This is not only a must for your body, but it will make you get up more for your bathroom breaks. And while you're at it, add some extra laps around the building while you are getting up to walk around to and from your desk. Sit on an exercise ball or get a desk where you can switch between sitting or standing. Add variety to your after-work activities. Don't just go home and continue sitting and vegging out. Be social. Take a yoga class or rekindle an old hobby. Bring more nature into your day. You can do this by eating lunch outside, bringing plants and other natural elements in that make you happy. You can decorate your space with nature photos or family photos. And make sure your desk is free of clutter and piles of paper that stress you out. So these are just a few, but again, a little goes a long way. It really is in the small and simple habits where real and lasting healthy change can happen. To reiterate what I mentioned in the beginning, sitting and desk working and device addictions are becoming a huge problem in our society. I am so thankful for technology and device conveniences, for sure, but it's getting way out of balance, and our declining physical health and mental health is proof of that. You've seen it, you have felt it, and we really have to be mindful about creating a healthy relationship with all this stuff. So I hope you will take these tips to heart, implement them, and create your own healthy habits.
Randy Kay blogs about taking care of ourselves. You can follow her at naturallyrandyk.com. That's RANDIK.com. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 25th. The Garrison Dam had a considerable impact on the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara nations, the three affiliated tribes. In 1947, the coming flood forced them from 94% of their agricultural land. 1,700 Native Americans were forced to relocate. One organization that had fought the dam was the United Church of Christ, especially church leaders Harold and Eva Case. When the United States first proposed the dam in 1944, the Cases had spent 20 years on the reservation among the Native Americans. Harold wrote letters to over 15,000 churches urging them to have their representatives oppose the dam. The church did not want to abandon the reservation. About 6 years after the dam's completion, UCC members began noticing that the instability caused by the relocation was affecting the tribe's school systems, feeling the children were not receiving adequate education. To combat this, the Fort Berthold Council of Congregational Churches voted on this date in 1961 to create a committee to investigate the viability of a boarding home for youth, ultimately recommending a home for 6 to 8 students. Lee Rockwell from the UCC Division of Health and Welfare Services wrote a working prospectus for the home. The chair of the State Conference's Fort Berthold Administrative Committee, the Reverend Alva Taylor, went to work carrying out the plan, buying a home in southern Bismarck, where the home still stands today. Lynn and Midge Gaylor arrived in 1965 to be the first parents and administrators of the home, which became known as Charles Hall Youth Services, named for frontier missionary Charles Hall, who had begun an area boarding school back in the late 1800s. On April 1, 1966, the home had its first resident, with 5 residents total in the first year of service. Charles Hall Youth Services has grown much over the years. They now have 3 Bismarck resident halls in single-family neighborhoods, housing up to 20 foster children. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
President Trump claims that large numbers of non-citizens are registering to vote. Are the numbers right?
It's likely probably in the thousands nationwide. Again, a tiny drop in the bucket compared to the eligible voter population.
But just one improper registration can change the outcome of a close race.
My concern is it risks jeopardizing confidence in the electoral process.
That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll talk with Julia Ernst, a law professor at UND, about her upcoming lecture titled The Mayflower Compact and the U.S. Constitution. Ernst was inspired to research the topic by her mother, Janet, who will fly in from Michigan for Wednesday's event, and we'll get a preview from mother and daughter. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.